Okay, so it's a class about flavor. So I thought the best way of starting this is by answering the question, what is flavor? So the story is that each particle in the standard model comes in three different copies. And what I mean by copies is that these objects have exactly the same interactions to all gauge bosons in the standard model. So they essentially, it's a single representation. So same gauge interactions. But they have different masses. Which is just a proxy for saying that they have different interactions with the Higgs. So usually the word copies is not really used that much. People typically say flavors. Some prefer families or generations. These all have the same meaning. Let me start by making an example. So let's pick an up quark. Let's give it a flavor index. In principle, we could write our Lagrangian by using U1, U2, U3, of course, left, right, depending on the chirality. But in practice, we give names to these different flavors. And I don't know if you've heard all of them, but let's repeat them once more. This is what we call the up quark, which is a bit confusing because all of these are up quarks. Anyway, this is the up quark. Then we have the charm quark and the top quark. And these three guys have very different masses. So this object here has a mass, the up, of about 2 MeV. With the charm, we go up to 1.3 GeV. And the top is immensely heavy. The top is about 170, I never remember the last digit, let's say 170 GeV. And then we can play the same game for the down quark. Just to set up some nomenclature, the first generation down quark is called down. And then we have the strange and the bottom. And also here, the masses increase with the number of generations. So the up, the down has a mass which is similar to the up, just a bit larger. The strange is a bit larger than the charm. It's 0.9 GeV. And the bottom is 4.2 GeV. Okay, I could do the same for the charged leptons, actually also for the neutrinos. There are three copies, but in this class, I won't talk much about neutrinos because, well, the origin of the masses of this particle is clear and related to the Higgs sector. Neutrinos are kind of a different story and would deserve a class on their own. But already at this stage, we can see some pretty interesting things. So first of all, the masses of charged fermions, okay, I don't know how to write it, interesting things, interesting. These masses span 6 orders of magnitude. The lightest one is the electron, which is, I forgot, 511 keV, up to the top, which we said is about 170 GeV. So this is already pretty puzzling that masses can have such different values. And these are just parameters in the standard model. They don't have any deeper meaning. They are parameters that we fix to match the observations we have. And another interesting fact, which has stimulated lots of thinking and model building and trying to look for a theory where this comes as a result and is not just something that happens, is the fact that within for each species, there is a strong hierarchy between the different masses. So the third generation is the heaviest, or we could even say we define the third generation as being the heaviest. But in any case, there is a large gap between third and second, and between second and first. This, together with some of the features of the mixing matrix that describes flavor physics, but I will go back to that in a minute. These are pieces of what is known as the flavor problem of the standard model, which is nothing but saying, oh, look, these parameters in principle shouldn't have a precise value, a preferred value. They could be anything. Why do they choose to be arranged in such a way? The hope is somehow that the ultimate theory beyond the standard model is able to have these patterns as an output. Okay, this was some blah blah. Now I will start writing down things. So to put flavor in a more familiar context, let me start with the standard model Lagrangian. You know you can write the standard model Lagrangian as the sum of different contributions. I will divide it in gauge sector. This is what I call gauge sector. This LG contains all the kinetic terms of the gauge bosons, including the self-interaction. So, I don't know, G mu nu R for the gluons. You've probably seen this 1,000 times, so all of them. And here, in the fermion Lagrangian, we put all the kinetic terms of the fermions that include, via the covariant derivative, also the interactions to the gauge bosons. So this is the sum over all fermion species. Which are the fermion species? We have the doublets, and then the right-handed stuff. This blackboard is amazing. Anyway. But then, of course, that's a flavor class, so we don't have to forget flavor, because each of these objects has a flavor index, and we need to sum over these flavors. Okay. On top of this, we have two other components that I will call the Higgs sector. Here by L Higgs, I really mean simply the Higgs Lagrangian. So the kinetic term for the Higgs and the potential. And we know that this potential is minimized for a certain configuration of the fields. And picking the unitary gauge, we can always write the Higgs as, zero, its VEV, and the actual Higgs boson. So I won't really go in detail here. Now, a few important properties of the gauge sector. So first of all, it is completely fixed. By the gauge symmetry. And by the matter content. In fact, we remain with only three free parameters. Well, three. We constrain them with observations. And these parameters are the gauge couplings. So G strong, G left, GY. Some people use different conventions and write G1, G2. OK. For me, L means SU2 left, and Y is hypercharge. So OK, completely fixed by gauge and matter content. And another very important thing is that this gauge sector has a huge flavor symmetry, global symmetry. F stands for flavor, which is U3 to the fifth. So imagine one U3 for each fermion field. For the doublets. and for all the rest. And this essentially corresponds to the freedom we have to rotate each field, for example, let's take Q left, in flavor space with a U3 rotation without affecting the gauge sector. Does that make sense? Okay. And now I want to move though to the part I'm more interested in, which is the Higgs sector. I already mentioned the part that concerns really only the Higgs. So now everything else I will tell you about today is concerned to this Yukawa Lagrangian. Okay, well, the Yukawa Lagrangian describes the interactions of the standard model fermions with the Higgs. We have to write it down. It has a conventional minus sign overall. All these objects carry a flavor index. So here, okay, let's write it explicitly. And we have the Higgs. Here, just to remind you, the Higgs, this is the charge conjugate of the Higgs field. And we have to do that in order for this object to be a gauge singlet. Okay, and then we have the leptons. Since we don't have right-handed neutrinos, at least in the minimal standard model, we just have one Yukawa term. And that's it. Okay, these YD, YU, YE are complex 3x3 matrices. Why do we like this interaction? This is the only standard model interaction that distinguishes between different flavors. If you think about it, it's the first, I mean, it's the reason we talk of flavor in the first place. Okay, now, of course, after we plug in the Higgs, and in particular, we concentrate on this first term, we see immediately that this will give us mass terms for the fermions, which are forbidden by gauge invariance otherwise in the standard model. The problem is that to be able to interpret these objects as mass matrices, we need to diagonalize them. And so now we are going to diagonalize them. Because as Mina says, there are a lot of matrices. Okay, so let's have a mini throwback. We want to diagonalize. Okay, that's clear. Please feel free to interrupt if something is not clear. It's the first lecture I ever give, so protest, shout, tell me if my handwriting is not working. Every feedback is very much appreciated. Okay, now from linear algebra, you might remember that for every Hermitian matrix, it is possible to find a unitary matrix such that U dagger M U is a diagonal matrix. So this object here is diagonal, but not only. It has real and positive eigenvalues. Okay, but the Yukawa matrices, they are not really Hermitian. They are just complex 3x3 matrices. However, it is possible to show that we can diagonalize them with a similar procedure, we would just need two unitary matrices. It's not difficult to show. I won't do it now, but if you want to try to show it for yourself and you have troubles doing that, I'll be here for a month and then we can discuss it. For the moment, trust me. So for any matrix, complex matrix, let's take YD. Since we already want to diagonalize it, let's take YD. So for any complex matrix, there are, this just has to be a 3x3 and complex, no Hermitianity. There exist two unitary matrices. Such that if we sandwich them around our initial matrix, we get something with the same properties of this matrix here. So something which is diagonal with real positive eigenvalues. In particular for YD, this is a diagonal matrix that contains the Yukawa of the D, of the strange, and of the bottom. And these are proportional to the physical fermion masses, because remember that Mi is just the Yukawa multiplied by the VEV of the Higgs divided by square root of 2. We can play the game for all the other matrices. So just to do give us some notation, YU will have LU, RU. The story will be the same, and the same for YE. And now what do I do? Can I go up with this? Yeah.
You can use the panel, like the electronic thing. Under, yeah, that thing.
This one?
Like the machine there, like the screen, yes.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Amazing. Fantastic. Okay. Okay, so remember our Yukawa Lagrangian up there. Now, we just found all those cute relations of the type LD, dagger, YD, RD is equal to the diagonal one. And clearly, we can invert this and just use them to rewrite our Yukawas. In terms of the diagonal ones. Okay, so if we do this, we can just rewrite our Yukawa Lagrangian. Let me do it only for the quarks. And for the moment, this is just rewriting. We haven't done anything. We haven't even done the real diagonalization. But now we have to remember that the gauge sector has that large U3 to the cube symmetry. And we can use this symmetry to rotate the fields and remove as many matrices as possible. For the moment, without changing the rest of the Lagrangian. Okay, let me do that. For example, I rotate QL as LD QL, and you immediately see that here this is gonna LD dagger LD is going to be 1 because they are unitary and I will remain only with YD. I do the same for all of them and I remain with this. this matrix here that at the moment looks a bit annoying because it's spoiling our diagonalization. We managed to diagonalize the up, but still we remain on with something on this side, is actually the whole point of having this class today, and it's called CKM matrix. So these three people were three very good physicists. C stands for Kabibo, K for Kobayashi, and M for Maskawa. And Kobayashi and Maskawa won the Nobel Prize in 2008. Okay, anyway, for the moment, this just looks like a problem. We have this matrix. We haven't been able to diagonalize our Yukawa Lagrangian. And we want to do it to be able to identify this with the masses. And there is a way to do it. And it is to rotate only part of this doublet again. I'm losing chalks. In particular, the rotation we have to do is U left going into V U left. I removed the CK. Whenever I write V now, I mean the CKM. If we do that, we won. We are in the mass basis. However, this rotation will give an observable effect in the... Okay, let's see if I can do this again. Ooh. Will give an observable effect in the gate sector. And can you imagine where?
Claudia, you can also get those parts down. There's like four, one, two, three. That they all come in.
Oh, wow.
So you have 8 boards.
It's okay. I'll just do some physical activity. The result is not amazing. Okay, so what do you think this rotation will have an effect? Only for those that don't know it already.
Is it in the fermionic gate sector?
Sorry?
Is it in the fermionic gate sector?
Yeah, of course we are rotating a fermion, so it's going to be there. But where? It will be in the only interaction that distinguishes between up and down quarks, which is the charge-current interaction. Now, in the mass basis, this will look like this. Of course, plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, this is the famous Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix, so let's give it some color. And before having a closer look at it, let's appreciate what it does. Remember that here we could only have transitions among the same family. So up to down, charm to strange, top to bottom. With the CKM now at tree level, we mediate transitions between different flavors. And the second important point is that this little object is the source of all flavor changing interactions in the standard model. FC stands for flavor changing interactions in the standard model. That's not generally true beyond the standard model. And not only this, we always have to remember that while it is more practical to work in the mass basis and then to move this V to the gate sector, the origin of this is ultimately the Yukawa sector. So flavor physics and Higgs physics are deeply intertwined. Okay, now phenomenology of this CKM. So if I ask you, how many physical degrees of freedom do you think the CKM has? What would you tell me? So it's a unitary matrix. 3 by 3.
Nine entries, but RL, you said it's complex, right?
It's complex, yes, but unitary. Okay, I can spare you the math. For a unitary 3 by 3 matrix complex, we have, okay, let's do the n by n case, n by n unitary matrix. It has n squared parameters that we can divide in two categories. It's useful to divide them into angles and phases, so essentially the moduli of the number and the phase. And in particular, these are the angles. And then and these are the phases. So if we do this for the CKM, naively, it looks like it has 9 parameters, out of which 3 are angles. And 6 are phases. However, and now we are going to show why, only 4 of them are physical. Five can always be removed. There are different ways of showing this. I will show you one which is based essentially on the counting of symmetries. But it's perfectly possible that if you look this up somewhere else, you will find something else. But the result should be the same. Okay, so remember that the global symmetry of the flavor sector. Now we just care about the quarks, so let me forget the leptons. We have a U3 cube, so one of cube for Q left, one for D left, and one for U left. Okay. Now, the Yukawa Lagrangian breaks this symmetry, and actually it breaks it down in the quark sector to only U1 baryon number. Only baryon number is conserved in the quark sector in the Yukawa Lagrangian. What this means is that the number of broken generators, so essentially the dimension of GF minus the dimension of GF prime is 27. If you want to do the math, you can even account for the phases. Okay, let's do it. For example, here, 3 by 3 are angles. Then 6 times 3 are the phases. And here we just have one phase. So in total, we remain with 9 angles and one phase. Okay, but then we have to remember which were the degrees of freedom we started from. Where do we started from? We started from 2 complex 3 by 3 matrices, the Yukawa matrices. And they have a total of 36 parameters, 18 are angles, and 18 are faces. Oh, wait, I messed up, sorry. 27 is not 9 plus 1. This is 17 plus 9. No, 9 plus 17. I'm sorry. Let me check. Okay. Now, the number of degrees of freedom is the number of total degrees of freedom minus the number of broken generators, which is essentially the number of phases we use, the transformations we use to remove the unphysical phases. And if we do that, we remain with what? 18 minus 9 gives us 9. So 9 phases, 9 angles, and 1 phase. Out of these, 6 are the quark masses, and the remaining 3 are the CKM angles. So the conclusion, is that the CKM depends on 4 parameters. In a minute, I will show you 2 types of these parametrizations that are completely equivalent. The one you find on the PDG is called usually standard parametrization, and it is in terms of 3 angles, 1, 2, theta, 2, 3, theta, 1, 3, and 1 phase. And then there is the so-called Wolfenstein parametrization. Wolfenstein. I'll show it to you in a minute. So it's just a different parametrization. Rho, eta, lambda. So the nice part about the Wolfenstein parametrization is that it makes very explicit which elements are big and which elements are small. But keep in mind that they are completely equivalent. Now, before showing you that, I want to say one last thing. Maybe I could go here. Yeah, that should be more than enough. So we said that the CKM is unitary, and this unitarity implies a series of relations. So unitary just means this, no? And then we can write what this means for the different rows. For example, we can write something like this. And since the unitarity of the CKM is a prediction of the standard model, testing whether these relations are satisfied, these are all objects that we can measure in physical processes. So testing whether this is actually the case is a test of the standard model. Another nice feature is that for I different than j, this type of relations can be written in the form of triangles. Maybe you've heard the word unitarity triangle, or you've seen it as at a conference. So the most famous of these triangles. So when people say unitarity triangle, they mean this one, but there are others you can write down. It's for these indices, and it reads like this. Which is not very illuminating for the moment. But if we translate this in the Wolfenstein parametrization, the moment I show you a picture, you will understand. this becomes a very simple triangle in the rho eta plane. And the sides and the angles of this triangle are objects that we can measure. Okay, let's see if I can do this. Okay, this is a slide. I just wanted to show you how the masses of the different fermions span several orders of magnitude. The different colors correspond to the different families. So green is the third family, light blue is the second, and red is the first. Neutrinos are all very light, so it's not even clear which one is heavier than the other. Okay. These are the two parameterizations of the CKM. The first one is the one you find in the PDG. And this one is the Wolfenstein parameterization. Now, this lambda is a small parameter. These other objects, instead A, rho, eta, are order one. So by looking at the powers of lambda, you get a feeling of the structure of the CKM. And you see that, okay, let me move two slides further. It is essentially diagonal. Black means big. So it's almost diagonal, 9.9, 9.75. And then we have a certain hierarchy between the mixing angles. So the largest mixing angles are those between the first and second generations. Then the second to largest, those between the second and the third. And then the smallest ones are between the first and the third. Also, this is part of the flavor puzzle I was mentioning at the beginning, so this peculiar structure of the matrix. But now let me go back to the triangle. Okay, this is an example of the unitarity. It is the unitary triangle I was mentioning. The angles and the sides of these objects can be written in terms of CKM matrix elements. So by measuring those CKM matrix elements and seeing where they fit on this triangle, whether they actually form a triangle or not, we are able to test the standard model picture of the CKM, namely the fact that the CKM is unitary. And I want to show you the incredible progress that has been done since you were born. You were probably already not yet born by then. I was. Okay, there you see this little triangle, and then the different bands are measurements that were known at the time. For example, look at VUB. The measurement of VUB was that big green circle. This is where we are with VUB now. And you've seen that an incredible number of bands has added that wasn't there before. For example, before the... I should say, the biggest change between this and this was the advent of the B factories. B factories are experiments that essentially are meant to produce B mesons. They are built such that they produce many B mesons. And with B mesons, you have access to elements of the CKM that involve a B quark. By the way, B mesons were the venues where CP violation was discovered, and this was an important prediction of the theory. I forgot to mention it before, but if there were only two generations of quarks, and you plug the numbers here, you will see that there will be no phase, just one angle and no phase. So CP violation only makes sense because we have three generations. And finding and measuring CP violation was a very important test of the correctness of the CKM picture, and that's why they got the Nobel Prize. And okay, this was a bit of propaganda to show that flavor experiment can really make a difference. I'm looking forward to see how this plot will become in 10 years, because here you don't see it that well, but there are still some little tension, in particular in measuring VUB and VCB. So you can measure them in two ways, either by looking at a precise transition, this is called exclusive measurement, or by looking at a class of transitions, that's called inclusive measurements. And the two don't really agree. And this is a big topic right now in the flavor community. Okay, now I don't have much time, but there are two things I absolutely want to do. One is just a question to you, so just to stimulate your imagination. If I asked you to measure VUD, what would you do?
See the up quark, down quark interaction.
By which process would you take?
Like anti up quark decay to down with some weak poisson.
Can you give me an example? You can go even simpler. Go even simpler with baryons.
A neutron to
proton. Exactly. Beta decay. Beta decay is the strongest constraint. And how about VUS? Here, indeed, probably the simplest thing is to think of mesons. You want a meson containing a strange. Mesons containing strange quarks are called kaons. And then you want an up. So you either take a kaon that has inside both a strange and an up, and you make it decay leptonically, or you take, for example, the decay of a kaon to a pion and some leptons. So this just to... There are several transitions that can be used to measure the same element. But what do we do if we want to measure matrix elements with the top? There's no meson with the top. Loops. We look at loops. Because in loop transitions, we can have the top as an internal state, and then the process will depend on a combination of matrix elements, part of which will involve those with the top. Okay. Oh, in these last 10 minutes, I have to do the gym mechanism because it's too nice to skip it. So let's see if I manage to kill this one. Maybe before, a little remark about flavor changing charge currents and flavor changing neutral currents. So far, actually, we have mostly talked about flavor changing charged currents. So these are processes where an up is turned into a down or vice versa. These two have different charges. So in total, there is a charge difference of, well, depending on whether they are anti or not anti, modulus of the charge difference is one. These are called flavor-changing charge currents. They occur at tree level in the standard model. And we have seen some examples. But what about flavor-changing neutral currents? So these are processes where a down quark or an up quark is changed into a down quark or an up quark Okay, here I should have changed the flavor. So up going into strange. Yes. For example, a down going into a strange, or an up going into a charm, or vice versa. So these are processes where a down goes to a down, an up goes to an up, but of a different flavor. So in both cases, there is no charge difference. These processes in the standard model start at one loop. What this means is that they are loop suppressed, of course. So in general, rarer. Sometimes people refer to this class of processes as rare decays. So FCNCs and rare decays are sort of interchangeable concepts. And just to make an example of how big the difference is between these two, let me take two decays of the kaon. So let's take this one. Okay, this one is a flavor-changing charge current, no? Because in this guy, we have an up and a strange. And then for the kaon, let me take a flavor-changing neutral current. So here inside, this is another type of kaon. This is a charged kaon. This is a neutral kaon. Well, particular a K long. And this has an S and a D. The branching fraction, so the probability that these processes occur, is widely different. For example, for this one, it's 0.64. So 64% of the time, the kaon is going to a muon and a neutrino. And instead, the probability for going into mu and muon is about 7 in 10 to the minus 9. And you can play a similar game in the PDG if you want. You can look for similar patterns for BDKs. For example, compare the decay rate of this process to this one. Okay. Now, not only FCNCs are suppressed because they are loops, and then obviously loops make them suppressed, but there is another mechanism that can suppress them even more, and this is called the GYM mechanism. Okay, these people are Glashow, Iliopoulos and Maiani. And in a nutshell, the GYM mechanism is just the realization that in flavor-changing neutral current loops, the amplitude is always at least quadratic in the masses of the quarks. Let's write it down because this is important. In FCNC loops, the amplitude is always at least quadratic in the masses, in the internal quark masses. Another way of putting this is that in the limit of massless quarks, FCNCs are zero. They don't exist. I will just make one example, also because I don't have much time. But I will take an historical relevant one that was a puzzle for several years. And it's this guy here, the decay of the K-long in mu plus and mu minus. OK, there are two types of diagrams entering this process. Okay, we have a K-long, so an S-bar and a D. This is a W. Then this could be a photon or a Z. mu plus mu minus. And then there are this type of diagrams which are called box diagrams. So here inside we will have some quark ui. So here a matrix element vid, and here vis star, and the same here. So I have no intention of actually computing the loop. I keep losing chalks. For simplicity, I will consider only this diagram, and in particular the channel with the Z. Now the amplitude for this object will have something of this form. So we have four gauge couplings. I won't distinguish about the nature. I will just write a G to the four. They are four electroweak couplings. We have a loop suppression. We have the Z propagator, so 1 over mz square. Then we have the sum over all possible internal quarks of this product of CKM matrix elements. And then some function of the masses of the quarks. Now, yeah, so this function depends on the masses of the up quarks in the loop, and it is regular for the masses going to zero. So this object here is actually a constant that does not depend on the masses, plus some mi independent terms. Dependent terms. And the first crucial realization is that unitarity implies that this sum here multiplied by a constant is zero. So what this means is that the mass independent part of this loop function will never contribute to the process, never ever. Okay, but let's try to say something more about this object. For simplicity, instead of writing the whole product, let me call this lambda I SD. And the same unitarity relation that I used to, what I just used is this, SDU plus SDC plus SD top is zero. And I can use it to remove any of these also in the rest of the calculation. In particular, I'm going to remove lambda u sd, just to get straight to the result and then take some time to think about it. So the prefactor remains the same. And then we have lambda sd charm, and then the difference of two functions, one with the charm and one with the up. And then an analogous term with the top. Okay, there are several approximations we can make. For example, I lost another one. For example, in this parenthesis, mu is much smaller than mc. So this function will always win on this function. So I can neglect this. And I can do the same here. Then, in principle, if I just look at the masses, the top is much larger than the char mass. However, numerically, the size of these objects is very different. Because here, it's quite large. It's 0.2. While here, it is 3 in 10 to the minus 4. So the result is that the charm term, this object, wins by one order of magnitude. What did I do to my white chalks? One is here. Okay, so all in all, what's the result? Of course, it's just an approximate result. Let me write explicitly now the CKM matrix elements. And the first, so the first term in the expansion, one can show that it's quadratic in the mass. So the first term will be something like m charm square over mw square. Okay, so what do we see here? We see first the loop suppression. This is the loop suppression. And this is the gym suppression. The gym suppression sometimes comes from the mass part, like in this case, and sometimes from the CKM part. For example, there are cases where the mass that wins here is the top mass, and then the suppression doesn't come from m top divided by mw, because that's not a suppression, but comes from the CKM factors. In any case, gym and loop suppressions are the two mechanisms suppressing flavor-changing neutral currents in the standard model. Now, let me rewrite this in terms of G Fermi. In terms of G Fermi, this is something like G Fermi squared, 16 pi squared. These objects here are essentially this and this term in the CKM matrix. And back then, when only the light quarks were known, this object here was called Khabibov angle. This is essentially the lambda I've shown you in the Wolfenstein parametrization. So this whole thing becomes lambda. Okay, and then the mass of the charm squared. Why am I doing all this? Because historically, the smallness of this process of K long to mu mu was a puzzle for a long time. And in the UDS theory, so before the charm was discovered, the amplitude for K long to mu mu was expected to have the form G Fermi squared, with some suppression, of course, lambda, and then some cutoff. And the problem is that to explain the observed size of this process, they needed lambda to be of the order 2-3 GeV. While the natural size of this lambda would be G Fermi to the minus 1/2, which is 300 GeV. And the solution to this puzzle was indeed the presence of the charm quark. And I think my time is up. There are many more things I could tell you about flavor, especially about the techniques that are used nowadays to compute flavor processes, because it's about computing transitions that don't involve quarks, unfortunately. They involve hadrons. And then there are a series of non-perturbative techniques or techniques to merge perturbative approaches with data-driven approaches that are very interesting and developing, but not today. So that's it.